Mary Oliver with Joseph Parisi, recorded in Santa Fe, New Mexico, October 25, 2006.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Joe Parisi, and I'd just like to say thank you to the Lannan Foundation for asking me to be here this night to give this introduction. In the early 90s, a small book was published in England called The Hidden Life of Dogs. It was written by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, an anthropologist who had the brilliant idea to follow a group of dogs as they made their daily rounds unfettered, I guess I should say unleashed, through the city of Cambridge. Dr. Thomas's researches make curiously compelling reading, for dogs on the loose lead rather exciting lives. And the conclusions she reached are often surprising. Among other things, she deduces that, given their druthers, man's best friends would rather associate with their own kind. But then who can blame them? Dogs are so much more attractive than most human beings. She was also forced to conclude, or rather her suspicions were confirmed, that dogs not only think, but have strong emotions, including love. Other research into animal behavior since then has tended to support Thomas, and it now seems clear that previous scientists had grossly underestimated the capacities of the animal kingdom. Writers of fiction and poetry, on the other hand, have tended to the opposite side by anthropomorphizing the non-human world. Mythmakers and so-called nature poets, especially, have so often foisted the repertoire of human attributes and feelings upon hapless herbivores, flowers, clouds, large bodies of water, that literary criticism had to invent a term for this unfortunate habit. It's called the pathetic fallacy. For this reason, I would refrain from affixing the term nature before the title of poet in referring to our distinguished reader this evening. I also hesitate to link her name with those of the older school of romantic poets, Wordsworth, Keats, and company, and even with our own American 19th century transcendentalists, because their brief excursions into the countryside too often resulted not in nature sketches, but in wistful abstractions and bucolic reveries. They seemed to want to get away from nature into some hazy realm beyond this world. No, our poet is not like them, and she is certainly not like their lesser descendants, those facile versifiers who prefer cliches, not to mention rhyming dictionaries, to the rigors of close examination and the hard truths revealed thereby. Our poet examines the world with an eye any naturalist would envy. So intense are her life studies that in following her supple lines, we may be flattered to think the keen perceptions they express are our own. Her descriptions of flora and fauna in the wild are as exact as her figures for their behavior are brilliant. In her poem, Entering the Kingdom, she expresses the wish to learn something by being nothing a while, but the rich lens of attention. And what she has seen with her clear eyes is both wondrous and harsh. In the wild world, all is not sweetness and light. Or as she says in Skunk Cabbage, what blazes the trail is not necessarily pretty. In her encompassing vision, the world is a continuum where violence is part of the natural cycle of birth, growth, death and decay, of departure and renewal. She notes that, quote, nothing in this world moves but as a positive power. And in her poem, a certain shapeliness or sharpness in the morning air, she asks, But it's true, isn't it, in our world, that the petals pooled with nectar and the polished thorns are a single thing, and that love itself, without its pain, would be no more than a shruggable comfort. Her close reading of nature and its intricate organization forces her to reassess our place in the family of things, and her inquiries may force us to reconsider some of our own cherished assumptions. For example, in the poem, Some Questions You Might Ask, she wonders if our definition of the soul isn't too limited. Is the soul solid, like iron? Or is it tender and breakable, like the wings of a moth in the beak of the owl? Who has it and who doesn't? Why should I have it and not the anteater who loves her children? Why should I have it and not the camel? Come to think of it, what about the maple trees? In its diversity, the natural world is filled with marvels, and they are all the more to be valued because they are mutable and mortal. Of course, she says in Poppies, loss is the great lesson. And therefore she asks us, as well as herself, doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Her own response has been, I want to love this world as though it's the last chance I'm ever going to get to be alive and know it. Book after luminous book, this poet has presented a continuing argument against inattention, self-absorption, and bitterness. She has looked at the natural world and our place in it anew. And in her vision and revision, she has created a version of the pastoral lyric for our times. Reading these life-affirming poems, one can easily and readily agree with the author. The path to heaven doesn't lie in flat miles. It's in the imagination with which you perceive this world and the gestures with which you honor it. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a great American poet, Mary Oliver.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. That was, what do I do after that? I know what I do, but it wasn't intended. I'll open with a dog poem. I was going to do that anyway. Interesting how many of the quotes Joe used are from poems I chose to read tonight, so you'll get the whole show on those poems. This is a poem called Percy 1. I'm now up to Percy 9, but you're not going to get them all tonight, don't worry. Our new dog, named for the beloved poet, ate a book which unfortunately we had left unguarded. Fortunately, it was the Bhagavad Gita. Of which many copies are available. Every day now, as Percy grows into the beauty of his life, we touch his wild curly head and say, "Oh, wisest of little dogs." You'll hear more from him later. I have a terrible time finding the right book. The Swan, 28, and that's not right, so I have to find it. I'll do it quick. 78. That means I can't read my writing. And this is one that Joe quoted from. There's a mention in it of Mrs. Blake, and that is the wife of the poet William Blake. The Swan. Across the wide water, something comes floating, a slim and delicate ship filled with white flowers. and it moves on its miraculous muscles as though time didn't exist, as though bringing such gifts to the dry shore was a happiness almost beyond bearing. And now it turns its dark eyes, it rearranges the clouds of its wings, it trails an elaborate webbed foot the color of charcoal. Soon it will be here. Oh, what shall I do when that poppy-colored beak rests in my hand? Said Mrs. Blake of the poet, I miss my husband's company. He is so often in paradise. Of course, the path to heaven doesn't lie down in flat miles. It's in the imagination with which you perceive this world and the gestures with which you honor it. Oh, what will I do? What will I say when those white wings touch the shore? I have a new book out this fall, and I'm going to read, I think, maybe three or four poems from it. This is called, same as the first line, When I Am Among the Trees. It's in the front here. When I am among the trees, especially the willows and the honey locust, equally the beech, the oaks and the pines, they give off such hints of gladness. I would almost say that they save me, and daily. I am so distant from the hope of myself in which I have goodness and discernment and never hurry through the world, but walk slowly and bow often. Around me the trees stir in their leaves and call out, "Stay a while." The light flows from their branches. And they call again. It's simple, they say, and you too have come into the world to do this, to go easy, to be filled with light, and to shine. Another one that Joe talked about is a poem called Some Questions You Might Ask, about that soul, that strange thing. Is the soul solid, like iron? Or is it tender and breakable, like the wings of a moth in the beak of the owl? Who has it, and who doesn't? I keep looking around me. The face of the moose is as sad as the face of Jesus. The swan opens her white wings slowly. In the fall, the black bear carries leaves into the darkness. One question leads to another. Does it have a shape, like an iceberg, like the eye of a hummingbird? Does it have one lung, like the snake and the scallop? Why should I have it, and not the anteater who loves her children? Why should I have it, and not the camel? Come to think of it, what about the maple trees? What about the blue iris? What about all the little stones sitting alone in the moonlight? What about roses and lemons and their shining leaves? What about the grass? We were probably, we'll probably mention the fact that I have lost a very beloved person. And there are a couple of poems I will read about that. Oh, you write them about yourself, but they become generic. Many people, many losses. This is called Oxygen. Everything needs it, bone, muscles, and even, while it calls the earth its home, the soul. So the merciful, noisy machine stands in our house, working away in its lung-like voice. I hear it as I kneel before the fire, stirring with a stick of iron, letting the logs lie more loosely. You in the upstairs room are in your usual position, leaning on your right shoulder, which aches all day. You are breathing patiently. It is a beautiful sound. It is your life, which is so close to my own that I would not know where to drop the knife of separation. And what does this have to do with love except everything? Now the fire rises and offers a dozen stinging deep red roses of flame. Then it settles to quietude, or maybe gratitude, as it feeds, as we all do, as we must, upon the invisible gift, our purest sweet necessity, the air. And this is called A Pretty Song. From the complications of loving you, I think there is no end or return, no answer, no coming out of it. Which is the only way to love, isn't it? This isn't a playground. This is earth, our heaven, for a while. Therefore, I have given precedence to all my sudden, sullen, dark moods that hold you in the center of my world. And I say to my body, grow thinner still. And I say to my fingers, type me a pretty song. And I say to my heart, rave on. Much fussing of the books. I've said this before, so some of you, if you've heard me read before, may have heard it. I tried to think many years ago of what I might do so that people would, who were not pre-converted, who were not looking for a poem, what I might do so that they would read it. You see, so often somebody in a general magazine, I see this on airplanes. You know, they're reading some prose, and then there's a poem, and they read one and a half, two and a half lines, and they're gone to the next page. And I don't know why that is, but I know it's too bad. And I thought of one thing that might help that was very different from just putting in more visual pictures or writing a better poem or whatever. And that was that anybody who's intellectually curious enough to begin a sentence was probably going to finish that sentence. You got it. Where is this thing? So a lot of poems, and those of you who know some of my books know there are a lot of poems that run very fast down the page and have a few dashes and semicolons, those useful things, and they're one sentence. And I've actually seen people start and they keep going. On the airplane. This is called The Sun. Have you ever seen anything in your life more wonderful than the way the sun, every evening, relaxed and easy, floats toward the horizon and into the clouds or the hills or the rumpled sea and is gone, and how it slides again out of the blackness every morning on the other side of the world, like a red flower streaming upward on its heavenly oils, say on a morning in early summer at its perfect imperial distance? And have you ever felt for anything such wild love? Do you think there is anywhere in any language a word billowing enough for the pleasure that fills you as the sun reaches out, as it warms you as you stand there, empty-handed? Or have you too turned from this world? Or have you too gone crazy for power, for things? Here comes Percy. I've survived 4 states with this poem, so there's hope. Percy 2. I have a little dog who likes to nap with me. He climbs on my body and puts his face in my neck. He is sweeter than soap. He is more wonderful than a diamond necklace, which can't even bark. I would like to take him to Kashmir and the Ukraine and Jerusalem and Palestine and Iraq and Darfur, that the sorrowing thousands might see his laughing mouth. I would like to take him to Washington, right into the Oval Office, where Donald Rumsfeld would crawl out of the president's armpit. And kneel down on the carpet and romp like a boy. For once, for a moment, a rational man. This is a poem called Peonies, and I operated the same way with a long sentence and then with short ones, which is kind of interesting. Peonies. This morning the green fists of the peonies are getting ready to break my heart as the sun rises, as the sun strokes them with his old buttery fingers and they open pools of lace, white and pink, and all day the black ants climb over them, boring their deep and mysterious holes into the curls, craving the sweet sap, taking it away to their dark underground cities, and all day under the shifting wind, as in a dance to the great wedding, the flowers bend their bright bodies and tip their fragrance to the air and rise, their red stems holding all that dampness and recklessness gladly and lightly. And there it is again, beauty, the brave, the exemplary, blazing open. Do you love this world? Do you cherish your humble and silky life? Do you adore the green grass with its terror beneath? Do you also hurry half-dressed and barefoot into the garden and softly and exclaiming of their dearness, fill your arms with the white and pink flowers, with their honeyed heaviness, their lush trembling, their eagerness to be wild and perfect for a moment before they are nothing forever? This is called Mindful. Every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. O good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these, the untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. I forgot that you had a printout of In Blackwater Woods, and therefore I shall read it. I just added it in. Russell, Russell, Russell. In Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds, and every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this, the fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go. There's one other older poem that I don't read too much anymore, but I thought I would make a special occasion of it tonight and read it. It's called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. See where I am. Oh, I brought one new poem today. This has not been published anywhere. It's called In the Evening in the Pine Woods. Who knows the sorrows of the heart? God, of course, and the private self. But who else? Anyone or anything else? Not the trees in their windy independence, nor the roving clouds, nor even the dearest of friends. Yet maybe the thrush, who sings by himself at the edge of the green woods, to each of us, out of his immaculate body, his own feathered limits, of every estrangement, exile, rejection, their death-dealing weight. And then, so sweetly, of every goodness also to be remembered. I read once many years ago with William Stafford, and I had, I think, 2 books at that time, and I proudly carried them to the podium. And later he read, and he just sauntered up to the podium. He didn't have any books. He just reached in his back pocket and took out a few crumpled pieces of paper and opened them and read absolutely wonderful new poems. Maybe I'll get there someday. I'm looking for beans. Beans are 75. This is a prose poem. You'll feel the difference, of course. They're not like peaches or squash. Plumpness isn't for them. They like being lean, as if for the narrow path. The beans themselves sit quietly inside their green pods. Instinctively, one picks with care, never tearing down the fine vine, never not noticing their crisp bodies or feeling their willingness for the pot, for the fire. I have thought sometimes that something, I can't name it, watches as I walk the rows, accepting the gift of their lives to assist mine. I know what you think. This is foolishness. They're only vegetables. Even the blossoms with which they begin are small and pale, hardly significant. Our hands or minds, our feet hold more intelligence. With this, I have no quarrel. But what about virtue? Oh, I think I'll read the longer one now. And that's in this book. This poem also takes its title from the first line. 141. I am so sorry. Where are you? I'll try this poem. Aha. I'll get there now. It's called, Have You Ever Tried to Enter the Long Black Branches? It's a little longer poem. Have you ever tried to enter the long black branches of other lives? Tried to imagine what the crisp fringes full of honey hanging from the branches of the young locust trees in early summer feel like? Do you think this world is only an entertainment for you? Never to enter the sea and notice how the water divides with perfect courtesy to let you in? Never to lie down on the grass as though you were the grass. Never to leap to the air as you open your wings over the dark acorn of your heart. No wonder we hear in your mournful voice the complaint that something is missing from your life. Who can open the door who does not reach for the latch? Who can travel the miles who does not put one foot in front of the other, all attentive to what presents itself continually? Who will behold the inner chamber who has not observed with admiration, even with rapture, the outer stone? Well, there is time left. Fields everywhere invite you into them. And who will care? Who will chide you if you wander away from wherever you are to look for your soul? Quickly then, get up, put on your coat, leave your desk. To put one's foot into the door of the grass, which is the mystery, which is death as well as life, and not be afraid. To set one's foot in the door of death and be overcome with amazement. To sit down in front of the weeds and imagine God the ten-fingered sailing out of his house of straw, nodding this way and that way to the flowers of the present hour, to the song falling out of the mockingbird's pink mouth, to the tiplets of the honeysuckle that have opened in the night, to sit down like a weed among weeds and rustle in the wind. Listen, are you breathing just a little and calling it a life? While the soul, after all, is only a window, and the opening of the window no more difficult than the wakening from a little sleep. Only last week I went out among the thorns and said to the wild roses, deny me not, but suffer my devotion. Then all afternoon I sat among them. Maybe I even heard a curl or two of music, damp and rouge red, hurrying from their stubby buds, from their delicate, watery bodies. For how long will you continue to listen to those dark shouters, caution and prudence? Fall in, fall in. A woman standing in the weeds. A small boat flounders in the deep waves, and what's coming next is coming with its own heave and grace. Meanwhile, once in a while, I have chanced among the quick things, among the immutable. What more could one ask? And I would touch the faces of the daisies, and I would bow down to think about it. That was then, which hasn't ended yet. Now the sun begins to swing down. Under the peach light, I cross the fields and the dunes. I follow the ocean's edge. I climb. I backtrack. I float. I ramble my way home. This is a small poem on the smallest thing I ever wrote about, I guess. It's called The Gesture. On the dog's ear, a scrap of filmy stuff turns out to be a walking stick, that jade insect. This one scarcely sprung from the pod of the nest, not an inch long. I could just see the eyes, elbows, feet nimble under the long shanks. I could not imagine it could live in the brisk world, or where it would live, or how. But I took it outside and held it up to the red oak that rises 90 feet into the air. And it lifted its forwardmost pair of arms with what in anything worth thinking about would have seemed a graceful and glad gesture. It caught onto the bark. It hung on. It rested. It began to climb. This is called Bear. Beans, Bear. It's not my track, I say, seeing the ball of the foot and the wide heel and the naily untrimmed toes. And I say again for emphasis to no one but myself, since no one is with me. This is not my track, and this is an extremely large foot. I wonder how large a body must be to make such a track. I am beginning to make bad jokes. I have read probably 100 narratives where someone saw just what I am seeing. Various things happened next. A fairly long list. I won't go into it. But not one of them told what happened next. I mean before whatever happens. How the distances light up. How the clouds are the most lovely shapes you have ever seen. How the wild flowers at your feet begin distilling a fragrance different and sweeter than any you ever stood upon before. How every leaf on the whole mountain is a flutter. I'm looking for... I suddenly realized I wasn't reading any prose poems, and it would be nice to do that. I didn't even know I published that one. I've been thinking about doing it. I was what I'm looking for. This is called Goldfinches. It's two, as I say, it's a prose poem. Some goldfinches were having a melodious argument at the edge of a puddle. The birds wanted to bathe, or perhaps just to dip their heads and look at themselves. And they were having trouble with who should be first, and so on. So they discussed it while I stood in the distance, listening. Perhaps in Tibet, in the old holy places, they also have such fragile bells. Or are these birds really just that? Bells, come to us, come to this road in America. Let us bow our heads and remember now how we used to do it, say a prayer. Meanwhile, the birds bathe and splash and have a good time. Then they fly off, their dark wings opening from the bright yellow bodies, their tiny feet all washed, clasping the air. I'm supposed to look at the time a little bit. We have time. This is the opening poem in the new book, Thirst. This is called Messenger. My work is loving the world. Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbird, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums. Here the clam, deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing since all the ingredients are here, which is gratitude to be given a mind and a heart and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all, over and over, how it is that we live forever. I have a feeling Joe is going to talk about this book a little bit, so I'll read a couple more from it. This is called Praying. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention. Then patch a few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks, and a silence in which another voice may speak. This is called In the Storm, from the same book. Some black ducks were shrugged up on the shore. It was snowing hard from the east, and the sea was in disorder. Then some sanderlings, 5 inches long, with beaks like wire, flew in, snowflakes on their backs, and settled in a row behind the ducks, whose backs were also covered with snow. So close, they were all but touching. They were all but under the roof of the ducks' tails, so the wind pretty much blew over them. They stayed that way, motionless, for maybe an hour. Then the sanderlings, each a handful of feathers, shifted and were blown away out over the water, which was still raging. But somehow they came back, and again the ducks, like a feathered hedge, let them crouch there and live. If someone you didn't know told you this, as I am telling you this, would you believe it? Belief isn't always easy. But this much I have learned, if not enough else, to live with my eyes open. I know what everyone wants is a miracle. This wasn't a miracle. Unless, of course, kindness, as now and again some rare person has suggested, is a miracle, as surely it is. Uh-huh. Oh, anguish. If somebody switched these covers, I'd really be... I'd be no worse off. This is, again, a poem, a little longer lines, but a 36-line poem. It's called White Owl Flies Into and Out of the Field. Coming down out of the freezing sky with its depths of light, like an angel or a Buddha with wings, it was beautiful and accurate, striking the snow and whatever was there with a force that left the imprint of the tips of its wings 5 feet apart, and the grabbing thrust of its feet, and the indentation of what had been running through the white valleys of the snow. And then it rose gracefully and flew back to the frozen marshes to lurk there like a little house light in the blue shadows. So I thought, maybe death isn't darkness after all, but so much light wrapping itself around us, as soft as feathers, that we are instantly weary of looking and looking, and shut our eyes, not without amazement, and let ourselves be carried as through the translucence of mica to the river that is without the least dapple or shadow, that is nothing but light, scalding aortal light, in which we are washed and washed out of our bones. This is this is a poem I wrote. I went to the Far East, but wrote very few poems about it. It was impossible. I didn't know the names of trees. I couldn't just say keep saying tree. it taught me sincerely that you must know the details. You must, you know, those are the materials. You must know the country that you're in. But this is one of them, and I knew what they were: the kookaburras and they are kingfishers. In every heart, there is a coward and a procrastinator. In every heart, there is a god of flowers just waiting to come out of its cloud and lift its wings. The kookaburras, kingfishers, pressed against the edge of their cage, they asked me to open the door. Years later, I wake in the night and remember how I said to them, "No," and walked away. They had the brown eyes of soft-hearted dogs. They didn't want to do anything so extraordinary, only to fly home to their river. By now, I suppose the great darkness has covered them. As for myself, I am not yet a dog of even a god of even the palest flowers. Nothing else has changed either. Someone tosses their white bones to the dung heap. The sun shines on the latch of their cage. I lie in the dark, my heart pounding. That was an interesting slip, wasn't it? It's Joe's fault. 5 a.m. in the pine woods. I'd seen their hoof prints in the deep needles and knew they ended the long night under the pines, walking like two mute and beautiful women toward the deeper woods. So I got up in the dark and went there. They came slowly down the hill and looked at me sitting under the blue trees. Shyly, they stepped closer and stared from under their thick lashes and even nibbled some damp tassels of weeds. This is not a poem about a dream, though it could be. This is a poem about the world that is ours, or could be. Finally, one of them, I swear it, would have come to my arms. but the other stamped sharp hoof in the pine needles like the tap of sanity. And they went off together through the trees. When I woke, I was alone. I was thinking, so this is how you swim inward. So this is how you flow outward. So this is how you pray. Poppies. The poppies send up their orange flares, swaying in the wind. Their congregations are a levitation of bright dust, of thin and lacy leaves. There isn't a place in this world that doesn't sooner or later drown in the indigos of darkness. But now, for a while, the roughage shines like a miracle as it floats above everything with its yellow hair. Of course, nothing stops the cold, black, curved blade from hooking forward. Of course, loss is the great lesson. But also I say this, that light is an invitation to happiness, and that happiness, when it's done right, is a kind of holiness, palpable and redemptive. Inside the bright fields, touched by their rough and spongy gold, I am washed and washed in the river of earthly delight. And what are you going to do? What can you do about it, deep blue night? That's not the wrong book. I think. Zero. I'm over. I'm going to read three more poems. not long ones. This is a prose poem, and it's part of a long series called West Wind. The young, tall English poet, soon to die, soon to sail on his small boat into the blue haze and then the storm and then under the gray waves' spitting threshold, went over to Pisa to meet a friend, met him, spent with him a sunny afternoon. I love this poet, which means nothing here or there, but is like a garden in my heart. So my love is a gift to myself. And I think of him on that July afternoon in Pisa, while his friend Hunt told him stories pithy and humorous of their friends in England, so that he began to laugh, so that his tall, lean body shook, and his long legs couldn't hold him, and he had to lean up against the building, seized with laughter, abundant and unstoppable. And so he leaned in the wild sun against the stones of the building, with his tears flying from his eyes, full of foolishness, howling, hanging on to the stones, crawling with laughter, clasping his own body as it began to fly apart in the nonsense, the sweetness, the intelligence, the bright happiness falling like tiny gold flowers, like the sunset itself, the lilt of Hunt's voice on this simple afternoon with a friend in Pisa. Thank you. One more word from Percy. And then one other poem I'd like to read yet. This one is called, it's Percy 3, but it's called Little Dog's Rhapsody in the Night. He puts his cheek against mine and makes small expressive sounds. And when I'm awake, or awake enough, he turns upside down, his forepaws in the air, and his eyes dark and fervent. Tell me you love me, he says. Tell me again. Could there be a sweeter arrangement? Over and over, he gets to ask it. I get to tell. And this is the last poem. It's called White Herod Rises Over Blackwater. I wonder what it is that I will accomplish today, if anything can be called that marvelous word. It won't be my kind of work, which is only putting words on a page, the pencil haltingly calling up the light of the world, yet nothing appearing on paper half as bright as the mockingbird's verbal hilarity in the still unleafed shrub in the churchyard, or the white heron rising over the swamp, over the darkness, his yellow eyes and broad wings wearing the light of the world in the light of the world. Ah, yes, I see him. He is exactly the poem I wanted to write. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I feel a little bit like that guy who does the interview program, the actor's workshop. What's up with the cards? Mary, let's chat.
I should have cards so I could answer. Yes.
We did not rehearse this. This is perfectly spontaneous. I think that all of us, of whatever background or persuasion, over many years reading your work early and late, have had a feeling of confidence and comfort. Because there's a, how could I express it, a kind of worldly spiritualism, or I might say secular faith, excuse the oxymoron, in your work. But in this last book, the latest book, I should say, not your last, I hope, what has always been sort of implicit, perhaps, and never stated so directly, is now very much to the forefront. Your expressions of belief and faith, in particular Christian faith, which hadn't been there before, which leads, of course, then to the question, I hope you don't mind, what is it that happened, a new revelation, a change of heart, that brought about this, really, I think, a major change in your work? Or maybe I was missing something before.
No, I don't think you were missing something before. I've not been a churchgoer. But it's simple, if I could say it simply, and I think it happens to many people. Sorrow opens us to many questions, including religious questions. And in seeking to go through that difficult passage, I, for the first time, sought the company of a congregation and the ceremonies of a church. Unusual that I would do that because I really don't like buildings. So to a very great extent, I'd rather be outside any time. But I did, and I did find support. I found comfort, which is probably why I went there. And then I found that I believed in a more specific way in the Christian faith. It just happened. I mean, it's called grace, and it happens or it doesn't happen. And I fell under the white cloud of faith somehow. So that part was very, very real. I'm apt to fall out of love with institutions, however. And so I don't feel such a need now. I'd no longer go to churches for comfort, but I go out to the fields to praise. And this book is about that passage, and I think both parts of it, I try to be honest in putting both parts of it in the book, because there's the kind of discovery and pleasure, and then there's a kind of departure from that as well. But that's been a very great thing in my life in the last couple of years, and there are ways to try to get through this through a hard time, and that's not a bad one. It's a very inspiriting one.
If I could do a kind of follow up on that, I think one of the attractions of the early work and now this last work is. You're not dogmatic, ever. In fact, there's a lot of ambiguity and ambivalence in your feeling, your relation to the world, a kind of acceptance that we are different from other things, and it's kind of a gap that the natural world has its own rhythms, its own mm-hmm. life, and then there's us. But you say, let me quote a couple of things. Mm-hmm. This is early and late, because I want to see how your feeling is maybe now, you know, from this new perspective. Mm-hmm. On thy wondrous works I will meditate. You have a poem, you say, about trying to be good and you know, reformation mm-hmm. of one's life. And you say, you ask, to what purpose? Hope of heaven? Not that, but to enter the other kingdom. Grace and imagination and the multiple sympathies, to be as a leaf, a rose, a dolphin, a wave rising, which is kind of a naturalistic, animistic mm-hmm. almost. And here's another. You from the poem you read tonight, In the Storm, belief isn't always easy, but this I have learned, if not enough else, to live with my eyes open. So that there is still this mm-hmm. sense that mm-hmm. one doesn't kind of blindly mm-hmm. go into mm-hmm. into faith. Mm-hmm. Let me forge on with a few more here, where you say in a pretty song, this isn't a playground, this is earth, our heaven for a while, which sounds very much like Wallace Stevens in my way of reading it anyway. And this is from a book, your 1990 book, which quite a remarkable achievement, poem after poem. Read it again with a different feeling this time, but House of Light. And in the poem, Roses Late Summer, do you think there is any personal heaven for any of us, you ask in this poem? Do you think anyone on the other side of that darkness will call to us, meaning us? You always had, through the poems, this continuum, as I said in my introduction. Mm-hmm. Do you feel differently about this now, this question of that supernatural element?
I'm still in the passage, so that mm-hmm. I have settled. I'm not dogmatic. mm-hmm. I could say. What did Emerson say? Each one of us is a universe, and there's a lot of things. Whitman said something like that too. I believe in the animation of all things. Mm-hmm. Do I believe in the divine? I believe the world is so extraordinary, and we know nothing about first causes, that in the first place we ought to be able to most willingly praise whatever it is that has made it, and have gratitude for our lives, and I like those two words better than comfort that you get in a church. And when I said for what hope of heaven, I was trying to apply not the heaven of the I don't even know the words to use, but of the Orthodox way of belief. But that heaven is entered the realms of grace and imagination. Mm-hmm. There's another line somewhere where it's in a different book called The Leaf in the Cloud, where I ended a poem saying, eternity is not later or in any mm-hmm. unfindable place. Mm-hmm. And there's that too. And one of my favorite lines, I'm digressing unless I want, but is again, Emerson's wonderful sentence, the invisible and the inconceivable are the sole fact. Mm. I think those are the right words. You know, if you can see it and it's material, it's a temporal form, and it has what I try to do is get the meaning. I've always said that. What does it mean that the world's beautiful? But and it doesn't. And I'm not going to get that answer out of any prayer book. I know that. I must get it for my own feeling. But when you find something wonderful, there is certainly a fierce enthusiasm. And now, it's as time has passed, and I've thought about it a lot, and gone to church a lot, and I've eased from the boundaries of the church, as it were. But I absolutely think a man could have walked on water with everything else that happened so wonderful. That doesn't bother me in the least. Doesn't a bird come out of an egg?
Plenty of mysteries in the supposedly most ordinary things.
Yes, yes.
Which leads me to another question. Years ago, just a few years before he died, I had a conversation with James Merrill. And as you know, he went through kind of transformation too, many actually. But this was shortly after the full Sandover trilogy came out. And I said, this is quite a strange and remarkable epic. It's longer than Paradise Lost. And among other things, he's talking about the destruction not only of this world, but of the soul afterlife because of our tampering with and misuse of technology and so forth. And Jimmy, in his usual way, kind of a throwaway line, he said, well, you know, we think about the so-called barbarians and the ancients, the pagans, and they did horrible things and brutal things sometimes, but they never really disrespected nature. In fact, they were in awe of it, and they tried to propitiate the gods and so mm-hmm. forth. We're the first who really got so smart that we have outsmarted ourselves and broken this bond, nature. And more recently, William S. Merwin has been talking about the fact that he feels compelled, and he said most poets probably feel the same way, that an almost desperate need to talk about the earth and what we've done to it mm-hmm. and the ecology. Jimmy said, well, you know, poets, of course, are going to be concerned about the destruction of the earth. That's our subject matter. Mm-hmm. And William said, yeah, we have to talk about it before it's too late. And do you sometimes get this feeling maybe that we're really in the desperate hours now?
Oh, I absolutely... totally believe we're in desperate hours, desperate straits, and I think we're plunging toward doom if we don't do something about it. But I'm not an environmentalist. Somebody said I was. I said no, I'm not, because my first reason for feeling we should must save the earth. We know we must, but there's a deeper reason, which is we should, because the earth is sacred, and that. Mm-hmm. And we are savaging it.
To turn to another topic, yes. not really that different, but about 8 years ago, you published a prose book. You've published several prose books, mm-hmm. but this one was in particular on prosody, mm-hmm. Rules for the Dance. And it's a wonderful text. Many of you probably have looked at it. It's not really like a textbook at all. It's very user-friendly, and it's short. And what I love about it is the fact that it talks about poetry and the techniques of poetry from the inside. You talk about mm-hmm. breath mm-hmm. and how that relates to meter and things like this. And a very refreshing, wonderful, as I said, user-friendly approach. You had actually written a handbook a few years before that. Now, you yourself are not a formalist, not an old-fashioned formalist. You don't use the repertoire of, you know, sonnets and all of this stuff. So I might ask you, what possessed you to write a book about prosody?
Well, what impelled me toward it is teaching and realizing that so many students, they no longer hear Mother Goose, after all, so they don't get the patterns of the iamb or the trochee into themselves, and they cannot read the early formal metrical verse with pleasure. And they must be able to read it with pleasure, because it's only when you get the music going, that the body, the sensual body of the poem going, that you want to pick up the sense of the poem. And in teaching, I realized they needed something put down that might help them, which is why I talked about the turning of the line and the difference between the trochee and what's the difference between a rock and a stone, all that kind of stuff. And I did it also on the sly reason was I decided if I wrote these two handbooks, I wouldn't have to teach anymore. which happened. I carried that out.
We were talking a little bit earlier today and a little bit about teaching. Mm-hmm. We're both of us now ex-teachers. The fact is that you never really took a writing course yourself when you were in school, did you?
No, I never did. And so when I was asked to come and teach, I really laid out entirely, without knowing what goes out in workshops, what would have been helpful, what I felt would have been helpful to me. And it was out of that came the book, Poetry Handbook.
I remember reading an article, an interview, this was some years ago. You haven't done many interviews.
So no, I don't.
I tracked it down. I forget
You're
where
special.
It was now. And you remarked that when you first went out to get a job as a young woman, you deliberately got boring jobs. Mm-hmm. You said you didn't mm-hmm. want an interesting job because you'd get interested
mm-hmm.
in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you wanted to keep yourself focused, obviously, on your real work.
Yes.
And I was thinking, I used to go around in my other life and talk to students in writing programs and whatnot. And I used to be kind of surprised, even appalled, because you'd run into kids 18, 19 years old who've got it all mapped out already, who this is where I'm going to go for grad school. I'm going to get my MFA there, and I'm going to study with XYZ, and then I'm going to try for this fellowship, and then the first book. And I'm amazed. They're very, very serious about their career in poetry, and eventually, I suppose, getting a job teaching other people to write poetry. Having been really most of your life a free spirit, not really in it, even when you talked, it wasn't really in the ordinary way. I think I could say that. What advice would you give to the young, the aspiring poet, not the young poet, but you know the people older who want to become poets or artists?
Well, to have the ambition to write better and better poems, much more than you have the ambition to publish, and to have patience with yourself. I think I gave my first reading when I was 40, and people just don't do that anymore. People want to hasten toward success. There's no success, because as soon as you've written a poem, which is sure to be imperfect, only God is perfect, you have a blank sheet of paper, and it's not a career. It can be a great pleasure if people just want to do it and don't want to publish. I think there are a lot of people that feel that way. They can help to straighten out their own lives with poetry. They need to enter. Everybody's a poet. They need to enter that creative spirit one way or another, and often if we do it with words. But to set yourself out on too much of a closed, narrow journey, then you close yourself off to the unexpected. And poetry is certainly about the unexpected, and you have to be ready to pay attention to it. It's sad to me to see how many poets don't consider doing other things except going right away to teach. Very young, you're not really ready to teach. You'd be better if you waited. It's not a thing to, what's the old joke? How do I get to Carnegie Hall?
Practice.
It's the same way. And you'll know the difference between hoping something is good enough and knowing something is good enough. And also read it. My school was reading. I admitted this somewhere. The only record I broke in high school was truancy. But I took books to the woods. It was a safer place. Mm-hmm. And read, trying to figure out how these, not just for the content, but how are these poems put together? Why does this line make me feel this way? You must, to be a good poet, this is certain, you must be fascinated by the mechanics of the language laid down on the page. And, there are no shortcuts, there are no certainties. But somebody who very, very much wants to be a poet and becomes harnessed in an academic job very early is going to be a very unhappy person. It's best to take a chance on yourself. I said that in the book, too. You know, cherish what you love doing. Live cheap. That's the other thing. People often, because I was a free spirit, people more than once assumed that I had a private income. Well, I had no income. But I learned to clam. I didn't need a Volvo or built-in bookcases, which I was sometimes shown by young poets when I went to read somewhere. And, I just kept writing. And I learned to get up early. It's another thing. And write early in the morning at my freshest. And I always said I gave my boss of whatever job I had my very best, second best energy. But, you know, all who want to should try it and give it all you've got. But if you go into the academic world, you're with paper and words all day long and all night long, and you don't even remember what a piece of 2x4 feels like. You know, you must be in the material world. You must be paying attention to things. You must be looking for new experiences and reaching deeper and deeper into those associations and relationships, and especially your own thoughts and your own feelings to be a poet.
I think the thing that struck me as an editor, we got a lot of poems, and I felt that so much of the poetry that we would see, particularly from students or professional poets in the academy, were about poems. Mm-hmm. And they were about technique. And you know, as I got older and I aged past, I go straight to heaven, having served my purgatory down here on earth with all those manuscripts. I felt that they weren't serious anymore. That it was very well put together. They were up on all the latest tricks. And you'd get through and say, well, so what? Mm-hmm. You can see I was a very bad editor. That I was so old-fashioned to want something more.
Oh, yes. As I've said in print, you were even good at rejecting.
Well, you know, you were one of those rare people. You see, the really good poets, you and Jimmy and John Ashbery, if I would happen to be so timid as to point out, well, I wonder about that line, or it's always a very technical thing. I would never question, you know, the meaning of the poem or, you know, the overall structure, but I might say, do you really want that word? They were invariably, like you, would say, thanks, or you saved me from that. It's always the middling talents, I think, who get very, very uppity. I remember when I first started out, I was the first reader for many years, and the only one. You know, we were a small staff. And I was so naive that when people in a cover letter would say, I would like criticism, I would write back something critical. And of course, I misunderstood completely. They didn't want criticism. They wanted praise. And I would get these letters. Well, how dare you? You know nothing about poetry. And so forth. So I didn't. And then there wasn't time anymore to do it. But I should have learned. Can I tell you one story about teaching? Because it happened very early on in my career and was a humbling experience that served me well. I just finished up grad school at University of Chicago, a very hypercerebral place where the life of the mind is quite deadly. And they teach you everything in graduate school except how to, you know, what you're going to do, which is teach. And so one of the courses, it was my first teaching job, the very first quarter, or semester it was one of those survey courses of Western monuments, masterpieces of Western civilization. You know, oh, it's the sixth week. I guess we're on paradise, you know, the inferno or whatever. And so I thought this was not too long after it was discovered that God was dead. And so I thought it would be a great idea. We would start from Homer, and we'd wind up in Dostoevsky. And I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the death of God. And so I prepared the way, I thought, beautifully, brilliantly, by talking about, you know, the Renaissance and the growth of science and how rationalism and the Enlightenment, with more we got to know about the universe, the physical world, the less the supernatural came into play. And I was going on and on. And I remember, though, vaguely, someone telling me, every now and again you should look up from your notes and ask if there are any questions. And I think it was after about the third hour, after this brilliant exegesis I was giving, this was, did I tell you, this class was at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I looked up and I said, are there any questions? And way at the back, the little girl timidly raised her hand, and she said, well, Professor, is there a God? And, you know, I wasn't prepared for this. You know, I picked my job, and I blurted out. I didn't have time. I said, well, how would I know? and she said to me, well, when you get your PhD, don't they tell you? Anyway, I think in great poems such as you have given us, we do get at least an intimation of these questions. And maybe it would be in a way disappointing if we really did get the answer. You
absolutely
know?
It's a mystery.
Yeah.
What's wrong with the mystery?
Leave it that way.
We can praise a mystery.
Thank you, Mary.
Day. Thank you, Joe.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.